Have you ever had an idea for a physical product that you just knew had the potential to change the world? Maybe it was something you dreamt up in your garage or a solution to a problem you encountered in your daily life. Whatever it was, you knew it was a winner. If only you can turn that idea into something. You are not alone. Countless entrepreneurs and innovators have stood exactly where you stand, filled with passion and drive, but unsure of where to begin. That's where the Builder Circle comes in.
My name is Seda Evjeman, and I'm a mechanical engineer, hardware enthusiast, and hardware mentor. I've had the privilege of working with numerous hardware companies that are passionate about solving some of the biggest challenges in the world. And I will be your host as we explore the exciting and complex world of physical product development. Very excited to announce that this episode is sponsored by our friends at Onshape and Jigga. Starting with Onshape, Onshape is the only cloud-native product development platform. Onshape combines professional-grade CAD with built-in PDM and real-time collaboration tools all in one system with no downloads required. Through the Onshape Startup Program, eligible hardware startups receive free access to Onshape Professional for 1 year, including integrated CAM. Apply now at onshape.pro/thebuildercircle. You can also find this link in the show notes. Now we're on to our second sponsor, Jigga.
If you're sourcing custom parts, you know the choice. Instant quote platforms that hide suppliers behind a black box or local shops that run out of capacity when you need them. Jigga gives you both. Direct access to vetted manufacturers, reliable capacity, and competitive pricing. From prototype through production. You communicate directly with the people making your parts, you apply your expertise, you make the right calls. That's what professional hardware sourcing looks like. Visit jigga.io. Okay, welcome to the Builder Circle. Today is by far the most special day for me because I get to interview the Darby Dunn. Welcome to the show, Darby. I'm so excited to have you.
Hey, Sarah. Thanks for having me. I'm so super excited to be here.
So just to give our listeners a taste of who Darby is and just talk a little bit about her. So Darby is the Vice President of Advanced Manufacturing at Commonwealth Fusion Systems, which is our kind of crown jewel of Boston fusion startup, and where she leads the build out of fusion energy hardware and the production systems needed to bring commercial fusion power to market, which is very distinctive and very important. Darby and I actually worked closely together at CFS roughly 5 years ago on the superconductor cable development, and it was just the greatest joy of my life, genuinely. And she just brings a rare mix of technical rigor, deep manufacturing acumen, and strategic leadership that just elevates everyone around her. It was such a privilege and pleasure to work with you, Darby, throughout the years. And prior to CFS, she spent a decade at SpaceX scaling manufacturing for the Dragon spacecraft that delivers cargo and astronauts to the International Space Station. And that experience is what now she applies to climate-driven deep tech at an industrial scale. Whew, that is just, if the listeners are not excited, you can tell I am. I'm just so thrilled. And I guess actually, Darby, could you, not to put you on the spot, but would you be able to talk a little bit about the toroidal field model coil and the central solenoid model coil, which were two huge milestones for CFS? Could you just like really quickly talk about them? Because those obviously blossomed under your leadership. So I would love to hear it from your side too.
Sure. I think to help put them in context, it's to help explain the acronyms. So what is CFS up to? So our mission is to bring clean fusion energy to the world. And we started out with a number of milestones to work up to our end goal of thousands of power plants around the world. So we're going to be building those power plants we call ARC. The first one we plan to have on the grid in the early 2030s in Virginia. And then the power plant prototype we're building now is called Spark. So that's a little bit smaller scale device, which is going to prove more energy out than in at a commercial scale for the first time ever. And before we even got that technology started, we needed to prove out the kind of key technology differentiator from what we're building for fusion versus what's been done in the past for other types of fusion machines. And that all comes down to the secret sauce, which are these superconducting magnets. So the two magnets you mentioned are called both model coils. So they're demonstration magnets to prove out more on a prototype scale, does this technology work? Does the physics work? Can we have Can we develop manufacturing processes to actually build these things? And then from there, prove that they work. And then that unlocks the building of the machine themselves. So the TFMC is the toroidal field model coil. So it looks like a big capital letter D. And that magnet, its job is to squeeze the plasma inside the machine, get it really dense. And then the CSMC is the central solenoid model coil. So that magnet, along with the poloidal field magnets, they pulse and they swirl the plasma around inside the machine. And that, in conjunction with the TF magnets, is what causes the actual fusion power to come out. Though both of those demonstration magnets were proving that this technology works, that we can build them, we can build them at scale. And then from there, now it's building out the rest of the machine.
Perfect. I think the most impressive part about them is how much magnetic field they can produce in such a small form factor. With the TFMC, CFS proved that they can achieve 20 Tesla on something that it was. How small was it? How big was it? Remind me.
It was roughly 10 feet from end to end once fully assembled. And yeah, to help put 20 Tesla in context, a typical hospital MRI machine is about 1.5 to 3 Tesla. And right. I got some cool YouTube videos. You can watch chairs getting sucked into MRI machines. So imagine that scale times 12 is basically what we're building. And when we built the TFMC, our math said that we could levitate a semi-truck, given how powerful those magnets were. Safety told us we could not.
Oh, darn. That would have been such good marketing.
Yes. The TF magnets we're building now for Spark are about double in size, so roughly 20 feet long. The math on that one is you could levitate a very small aircraft carrier. So yeah, absolutely impressive, the strength of these magnets. And so when we say 20 Tesla, like, that's a big deal.
It's huge. Yeah. And for the CSMC, which was much smaller in form factor, it was able to achieve 5.7 Tesla while carrying currents up to 50,000 amps, which, I mean.
Yeah. Also pretty insane. Yeah. A good comparison for that. You charge your phone at night with 1 amp. So think about charging 50,000 cell phones all at once, basically take not quite the capacity of Gillette Stadium and charging all those cell phones all at once with this one magnet.
That's just incredible. And CSMC is the project that I had the pleasure of working on with the team and with Darby. So it's just, it's crazy when I saw the test results come out. It's just, I can't wait for all of this to come online and see the incredible stuff that CFS has been doing all together. Integrated, and it has your fingerprints all over it. And this is why I feel so excited and privileged to be able to talk to you today, because I feel like there have been so many lessons that I learned through my time at CFS from you and just being in the company. But also, I think that there are so many lessons and pitfalls that others could avoid, specifically people who are working on deep tech and industrial technology. And today's episode is really going to focus on the operational side of things, of just like actual execution work, manufacturing, all of the decisions that come into play and all of that. And I get to pick the brain of Darby Dunn. Who better to answer these questions? You have thought of these millions of times and been in millions of micro decisions that led to several huge deployments. So I can't wait. Okay, actually diving right in from my first question that I have, which is like where everything begins, is how do you approach insourcing versus outsourcing? In your mind, like how does that affect the team, the org structure, but also just like purely from a manufacturing standpoint, just open-ended, we'll see where it takes us.
Yeah, I would say this is definitely one of the key decisions you need to make early on in a company. And I think a good rule of thumb is you want to insource anything that you would consider a core competency. And so a core competency, good way to define that is it's something that gives you a competitive advantage. Where can you beat your competitors? Where do you really have the best product market fit? And you're offering something that doesn't yet exist. And I think three key questions you can ask yourself to define, is it a core competency? The first question is, can you be the best in the world at it? Second question is, will this help you scale? And will it help you scale fast? And then the third question is, does this help improve your company's number one metric? And so you need to first define what is that number one metric. At SpaceX, the metric that we used that is most critical was dollar per kilogram of payload to space. Part of SpaceX's overall mission is to make life multiplanetary. And to do that, you need to have a cost-effective way to get a lot of heavy stuff into space. And so if that is super expensive, then you don't really have a good business model. And if you look at over the last 20 plus years that SpaceX has been around, They've actually 10x'd, they've improved that metric by 10x. Mm-hmm. So what is the dollar per kilowatt or dollar per kilogram into space? So a huge improvement there. And then for CFS, our number one metric is what is the dollar per kilowatt hour of electricity to a paying customer? While we're not yet building power plants that are deploying energy to customers, that drives every decision that we make. That feeds into what is the overall cost of the machine itself? What does it cost to operate it? How does that then affect what will a customer pay for electricity once the power plants actually start selling to customers? Because you can build a power plant that works, that is proves that fusion works. But if it's not economical, then again, you don't have a product that people will want to buy.
Totally. Two things really stuck out to me. I think that the metric piece is really important. The thing that I really like about both of those is that it's very actionable. A ton of times I feel like startups have ambiguous metrics of just make the best of X or make the cheapest of Y. And I think that having that like cost per dot, 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 per dot, dot, dot is a very good like framework to push people into. And that also, I think, makes you question fundamentally, what is your competitive advantage? Why does this even exist? And I feel like to get to that, you have to go do a lot of soul searching as a company, it seems. I have a follow-up question on the core competency bit of things. What if a lot of early stage companies tend to be operating on very tight budgets because of reasons like they're raising, they don't have a lot of money, et cetera. What would you reckon someone do if they need to have this core competency? It is going to be a part of their moat, but it just takes a very long time to get to that level. Like your first question of just, can we be the top of the world? Like maybe, but it's going to take so much time and money. How do you make that trade-off? How do you think about that?
I think that's super important as well. And some of it depends on what sort of IP, like intellectual property rights do you have in place? In theory, you could go to a contract manufacturer or other folks who could be building the early stages for you. But if you don't actually own the rights to that hardware or the design, then you risk your IP getting out and you're potentially damaging your business in that way. I think another kind of critical thing to think about is, how much capital, how much infrastructure does that take? I think one of the really key factors to CFS's early success is that we spun out of the Plasma Science and Fusion Center at MIT, and we actually built most of the demo magnet, the TFMC, at that facility. And that meant on day one, I could come in and I didn't have to build a factory. I didn't have to hire well-trained technicians because the PSFC already had them. We already had nitrogen plumbed to the walls. We had a 10-ton crane available. Great. All these things, that all this infrastructure that we didn't need to develop at the very beginning. And so we were able to leverage that fantastic partnership with MIT to build that demonstration magnet, prove it, that technology. From there, we ended up raising actually $1.8 billion for a Series B off the success of that magnet test. So from there, then we were able to build out a factory, build out an entire production team, build out a lot of our own custom equipment. That was something that we were more sharing with MIT for the demo magnet.
Yeah, just casual. $1.8 billion. I remember when we were told that. I think my jaw just rewind being like, is that B as in billion?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Amazing. Yeah, that does make a ton of sense. I think that early onset partnership is, if you can find it, I think is actually super critical. And the core competency existed, as you said, like with the technicians, and then also just from like a plasma standpoint of being able to handle magnets and concrete walls and all of that, all of the other operational things that you need. That makes a ton of sense. And in your mind, I guess you mentioned like working with partners, like contract manufacturers and all of that stuff. When you're in this zone of maybe there are reasons why you can't insource, it is a core competency, but you do want to work with outsourced partners, which actually CFS has done very successfully. The vacuum vessel, for example, was built outsourced. 48-ton steel vessel, by the way, guys. Like, it was shipped here in this massive plane that the nose lifted up for it to I watched the video. It's so cool.
It was super cool.
But how do you think about structuring those engagements? And do you see it as a co-development, or do you have very like harsh terms to make sure it's like totally kept in-house? Do you send engineers? I'm asking a lot of questions, but super curious.
Yeah, I think, it depends on the hardware and it depends on the supplier. For vacuum vessel manufacturing, we actually decided that is not a core competency of CFS. because there are people in the world who are already the best in the world. So from that standpoint, our vacuum vessel vendor, they are very good at their job and they know what to do. We designed it. We worked very closely with them on, you know, manufacturability assessments. And we have people that have taken many a trip out to see this vendor throughout the various build stages, through final inspections, leak checks, all that fun stuff, making sure that it is ready to go. So from that standpoint, that one made sense to actually outsource. And we chose the in-source magnet manufacturing because there was literally nobody else in the world building superconducting magnets of this size. So we said, all right, we, with our partnership with MIT, we can leverage that partnership to learn about how to make these magnets ourselves and develop that IP in-house. And then from there, scale that to what we're doing for Spark and then eventually for many arcs worth of magnets.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. And a lot of the work with MIT and TFMC actually happened during the pandemic, which was insane. To be able to cooperate all of those efforts while being remote and having it done, it was a time. It was a time to be alive.
I mean, I think, yeah, for those of us building the TFMC, I think we had, maybe about a month working from home. And so it was a lot of, all right, what documentation can we put together? What can we get lined up? And then I actually wrote the return to work procedure for that lab at MIT because it was like, as an operational leader, you have to do what you got to do to get the job done. Yeah, I wrote that and submitted that to the director of the lab, got it approved. And so, yeah, we set up very strict protocols for, what shifts we have and how do we make sure people are social distancing and wearing masks and just cleaning every step of the way. And we were able to do that very safely and build the magnet through 2020 and 2021.
Yeah, that was, I think, a huge feat. And I think that it was managed super well. Okay, so I guess going back into the hardware development cycle, in your mind, where does operations come into play and why is it critical? Specifically for those listening that don't understand the role of a COO or an operations manager or stuff like that, just to get more acquainted with the hardware development cycles.
Yeah, and I think operations can mean many different things depending on what company you're in. I think based on my experience, operations generally includes things like manufacturing, supply chain, quality, facilities, health and safety, IT, those types of things. The backbone of the folks that are physically building things, ordering things, keeping people safe, like all those things together. So my personal opinion is you should involve operations as early as possible. There's a lot of strategic planning and work that can go in before the rubber hits the road. And I think using that time early on to define, like, what are those critical business processes? You want something that's lightweight, right? You don't want to strangle growth of an organization, but I think having those kind of core parts of the business defined with a big focus on, like, how do you move really fast? How do you move really efficiently? I think having that foundation built early is so helpful when the company wants to scale later.
Do you feel like, I totally get you in terms of specifically, you don't want process for the sake of process. You want process to be able to actually enable people and projects. So I agree with that completely. And for early stage companies, who do you think should be your first few operator hires and why?
I can speak from my own experience. I was actually the third hire for CFS, brought on board to run manufacturing for the company and then help us scale for building Spark. And my job now is actually working on many arcs. You know, I think it's really important to get somebody in early who can think really strategically and also think really creatively. And then it's also important to pair those people with people who are really tactical and the get shit done personalities. So I think having both of those hand in hand are super important. I also think really early on, hiring experienced people matters a lot. You want people who have scar tissue, who have lived experiences building hardware, things not working, trying again, so you don't have to repeat some of those same mistakes. And then as well, depending on how much work you're going to do in-house and how many of your processes and equipment are novel, getting in really creative people who can design that equipment, they can build out those new processes, they can build out some of that structure, the systems I mentioned earlier, is really helpful. Because don't reinvent the wheel where you don't need to. So I think that's where the experience really comes into play. But I think that creativity is also really important. You don't want to get stuck in, this is how I did it in my last job, or this is how the industry always does it. There's a reason why you started this company. There's a reason why you think you can do something different, something that's never been done before. I think both at SpaceX and CFS, both of those companies really came in and with the goal of shaking up an entire industry, right? Mm-hmm. SpaceX came into very well-established old guard mentality in aerospace. And they said, nope, we're going to do something completely different. We're going to innovate. We're going to move really fast. And so we had a number of like industry experts who were really early hires at the company, but they also hired actually a lot of like young, bright, very talented people and said, all right, we're going to teach you a little bit of, you know, what we know, but we're actually going to let that fresh thinking, that new way of thinking really shake things up and shake up the industry. I think the experience matters, but you also don't want to be so set in your ways that you're not willing to innovate.
That makes sense. Yeah, it is. It's an interesting balance to be able to find the right people and the right mindset. I feel like people who have that institutional knowledge need to come into a startup and maybe have that notion of, I might be able to apply things that worked really well, but other things I need to be flexible in. Likewise, with younger folk that are going into it, they need to be really comfortable with the ambiguity and not being able to be given like exact tasks, but be creative and create them. And yep. And that's it's uncomfortable for a lot of people. It's not a standard operating way. I think it's important to acknowledge that. My question, you actually brought up something really important and I want to highlight it. And if you have any additional comments on that, I think it'd be valuable. We're talking about this insourcing, outsourcing. It's like everything feels like it ties back to that really, because it feels like from what you said, when you're hiring, it's also important to know what you are and knowing what you insource versus outsource. You don't want to get a manufacturing engineer maybe you do, but like you don't want to get 10 manufacturing engineers if you're going to outsource everything versus if you don't want to not have a supply chain manager if you're outsourcing everything. And so it's, do you see those like fundamentally entangled with each other?
I do. Yeah. I think deciding on those core competencies early, that does also help you decide who should your early hires be. I was contacted by CFS very shortly after, I think it was maybe their second ever board meeting, and the founders along with the board agreed of like, all right, we want a core competency to be manufacturing these superconducting magnets in-house. So as soon as they had determined that, then that's when I got the phone call and said, hey, have you thought about fusion? So I think, but yeah, it is really helpful to know what you want to do. What are those core competencies? So then you can grow your business from there.
Awesome. I think that's a good, just like a kind of bookmark for folk of just, if you haven't made that decision, don't rush into hiring someone just because it matches a different org structure. Or yes, if your completely. Investors are like pressuring you, like you need to have a COO, you need to have a CTO or whatever. I think this is like a good grounds to stand on and put a stick in the ground and say, we need to make this decision before that happens.
I agree. I think one other thing I'd add on the hiring front as well is you want to hire exceptional talent for every single position. And I want to be clear that exceptional doesn't mean elitism. That doesn't mean looking for only the top 10 engineering schools or only an extremely high GPA. It means you're looking for somebody who's exceptional, who's very good at their job, who I think, yeah, some of it goes back to that ability to be creative, to be adaptive. But I think it's somebody who has a really high drive, really high drive to succeed, who's delights others, and I think can be a good culture carrier for the company as well. And I think that level of exceptionalism can be in literally any position. And we're talking whether you're hiring for one of the most talented design engineers that you've ever met, or super creative equipment design engineer, or really hardworking manufacturing engineer, but it'll do your office manager, right? So somebody who is keeping the building running while the team is working on other things. It could be somebody who is your recruiter for hiring, or even the janitors, right? It's like you want somebody who does an exceptional job, regardless of when. I think it's really important, especially for early hires. Don't lower that bar. It can be so easy to fall into the trap of, I just need somebody. I just need a warm body. I need somebody who can do this work. You will regret it later. And it's like you're trying to fill an open slot that you have on your team. And as soon as that happens, you stop searching and you relax. I think it's always worth it to wait it out for somebody, even if it's a little bit harder in the interim and means you have to take on a little bit more work until you find that really great person. But when they do, it's like they are a force multiplier for your organization. And you want to hire somebody who can really help excel and drive the company forward as opposed to dragging it down.
Totally. That actually made me think of three separate things that I noted down when you were saying it. One is actually something that you talked to me about years ago, which was I think you were going through some interview processes for a position. I don't remember what position it was. I don't know what time it was, but it was. And you came out of an interview and you were like, yeah, we're not going to hire this person. And I was just like, wow, you're super confident in that. What went wrong? What did you not like? And it was so eye-opening for me. You were like, I asked them what went wrong in a project, or like in retrospect, what they would have done differently, and they said nothing. And they said there was nothing wrong and nothing went wrong. And it's just like daisies and butterflies. And you were just like, they clearly don't know how to build hardware. And I remember that because oftentimes when you're interviewing, you want to present yourself, you want to talk about your successes and all of that stuff. But actually, I think people more respect the failures and your ability to articulate them and articulate what went wrong and how you fixed it and all of that. So that literal, like, just connected to you. If this came up anywhere else, it would still connect back to you. That's what came up to me. Could you like speak to that a little bit of just how we need to, because that's something I'm very passionate about, is talking about failures and being more comfortable with it, please.
Yeah, I think that's part of being an engineer, right? It's testing a hypothesis and seeing if it works. And if it doesn't, what did you learn from that? Can you apply that to then help you figure out the right way to do something? And yeah, so I feel like if you've never failed, if everything has worked perfectly, then I'm probably not trying hard enough. you're trying to be a little too rose-colored glasses, perhaps in an interview. But I think, that's where you learn the most, is by failure. And if everything went perfectly every single time, then, you know, you might have a great product. You might have something that works really well, but you're not necessarily learning from that. So I think it's being able to, I think some of my, I would say in retrospect, maybe not at the time, but some of my like fondest memories at SpaceX were really diving into a failure investigation, and you're just like combing through the paperwork and trying to figure out what happened and looking through build inspection reports and doing like fishbone diagrams and like really just sinking your teeth into it. And that exercise in and of itself really helps you have a much better understanding of the whole system, how do things work, and it just gets your brain going on, oh, is there a better way to do something, or what can we improve next time? I think that's super important.
Absolutely. That's great. If you've ever worked in manufacturing or worked in a machine shop or something, that's what you learn. Basically, you learn that you remember your failures more than you remember your successes. I've had a ton of CNC tools break, and I remember every single one, but I do not remember every single part I built.
Yep.
The other two stories that came into mind, very short, is when in NASA, there's this, maybe you already know the story, they ask the janitor, so what do you do here? And they're like cleaning, and they say, we're sending a man to space. And that's the kind of like ownership that I think is, as you said, like exceptional people also have exceptional ownership, I think. And I'm assuming that's also a critical characteristics that you look for when hiring.
Definitely.
And the last one was the founder of Kayak gave a speech at a conference that I had gone to. And he said the first five hires, and five is obviously an arbitrary number, basically inherently develop the future of your company, and they dictate what will happen. And I think that you're so right. It's like you cannot rush that, especially in the early stages. In the later stages, maybe like it's a little bit more noisy. People might fly through a little bit quicker. But in the early stages, it's super important to be mindful. I agree.
Yeah, I've used generally more the phrase of the first 10 people that you hire, if they each hire 10 more people, right? Now you have a 100-person company. So get those first 10 hires right, because then that sets the tone for your 100-person company.
That's
think another, yes. Yeah, I think even a story there, it was actually my first week on the job at CFS. And I would get called into a room to talk about a candidate that the team had just interviewed. And I wasn't even part of the interview process, but I think just listening into them, and they were talking a lot about how this guy was very technically brilliant, could do the job very well, but he was a bit of a jerk. And so without actually having been through the interview panel, I said, I don't think we should hire this guy. And the biggest reason was, it was one of those first roughly 10 hires for the company. And that would set the tone for how we want people to treat other people. Mm-hmm. And this guy would have come in a management position. And it's also super important to think about for individual contributors versus people managers, that if they are going to also then become a hiring manager, it's people have somewhat of a tendency to hire culturally similar people. So if he thinks that's acceptable to be really rude to people and create an unpleasant work environment, then he's going to think that's acceptable for the people that he hires for his team. And then that just propagates throughout the entire organization. Very thankful we didn't hire a person. And so you know, that was, like one of those really early key decisions for the company that really helped, I think, continue us on the trajectory that we wanted of hiring people who are very respectful to one another and trying to create a overall kind and collaborative work environment.
Yeah, it comes down to engineering is easy, people are hard.
Yes, that's right. Yep.
But it's 50-50. The technical acumen is so important, but being strategic, compassionate, being able to motivate others is just so underrated. We're still people building people things.
Yep. Absolutely.
I think one of that says that. People building people things.
Yeah, put in your shop.
Sorry, you were saying something.
Oh, it's just one other key mantra that we had at SpaceX was that you always want to hire somebody smarter than you, or else you're making the company dumber. And it's a little bit crass, but I kept that. I still use that to this day because I think it's just such a helpful thing to keep in mind. And sometimes there can be a tendency of people to not want to hire somebody who they think will maybe outshine them or maybe surpass them for the next promotion or something like that. But at the end of the day, we're here to achieve a mission and we want the best people doing that work. So it's a really helpful thing to keep in mind of how do you keep making the company better with time? Like, hire better people.
It's also you get better. It's just so easy.
Exactly.
When you hire better people, it's you learn so much and it might not. And everyone has their domain expertise. No one knows everything. It's just, I think you have to have clarity on that. And it just gets easier to make that decision to hire someone that's better than you in this particular domain that is within your organization. I've loved this little interlude we did because I think it's super important. And it's like the crux of operations because all of these stuff, people, mechanisms, suppliers, all of these are humans working together and in a mechanism of its own. And your job is to make it work seamlessly. So it's a huge part. So actually, going back to a little bit more of the tactical stuff, talking about, so you said operations encompasses manufacturing, quality, safety, and so on. What of these decisions do you see people tending to rush and what downstream effects do they risk?
I think really high level, I think unless you have lived this and been burnt before, I think people tend to oversimplify operations and think that it's quote unquote easy. So I think that in and of itself is an early mistake. Because I think if you design something that's not manufacturable, it's prone to break and it could hurt people. That's not a good design. So it's really important to think through those things early and have all four of those disciplines working together in order to make a good product. And if you focus on one versus the other, you're going to be a bit imbalanced. So I think that's important is not just go full steam ahead, get any design out there, but it really is think about all four of those things working together. And then from there, that's how you know you have a good product.
And do you feel like it's often DFX, which is like design for manufacturability, design for quality, design for safety, all of these things need to come into play at some point? And I understand that people want to go fast, but I guess the perspective to have from what I understand you saying is if you don't have time or space, money for it now, you will not have it when it breaks or does something bad.
Yep. I think, another good mantra is if you don't have time to do it right the first time, you definitely don't have time to do it right the second time. I think that's something that, I've also said often to people when it's, we just need to get this out the door. I need to get this part ordered. I need to get this part made. But did you have a machinist review your print and make sure that it's something that actually is machinable? And I think it's, unless I think you've been through that design loop before, you don't necessarily, it's like you don't have that scar tissue to know if, I go talk to Brian in the machine shop, then he's going to be able to give me feedback in maybe an hour-long conversation, which could save me thousands and thousands of dollars on my part. or if I go talk to the supplier that's going to build this part and get advice from them on how to, oh, if you change the fillet on this one radius from X to Y, then, oh, that suddenly makes this part a lot easier to build. Or if you don't talk to the technician and say, hey, how would you actually put this thing together? Mm-hmm. Think through the order of operations. And like spending a little bit of upfront time could mean that you have a much better product and would actually save you a lot of time and money in the end.
So from what you're saying, it seems like it goes almost in twofold, where it's don't oversimplify something you don't understand in your mind, because a lot of engineers tend to really get the deeply technical, complicated parts and they know it's complicated. So they say, surely other parts are not as complicated as this. We'll be able to figure that out and then charge forward. Whereas the best thing to probably do is go in with curiosity and a little bit of humility. And from what you actually said, specifically when it comes to manufacturing, quality, safety, assembly, all of these are very tactical pieces to the puzzle. And oftentimes there will be someone that is a subject matter expert either in your company or externally who you work with that can give like a filter. It's almost like engineering filtering that you will not be able to look at it in that light. So that tends to be what people do and they shouldn't. Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah. I love what you said about that combination of curiosity and humility. I think that is so and so important. And I think for me, like it all goes back to teamwork, right? It's like we're all one team. We're all going for the same objective. A lot of the operations, the functions, they're not there to slow down the process. It might seem like that. It might seem, yeah, I really just want to rush and get this thing done. They're there to be a good teammate, right? They're there to give good feedback. And so if you approach that with that sense of curiosity and say, hey, I think I've designed a pretty good part. Like, how can I make this better? It's like, they're there to help you, right? They're there to help the company. They want the same thing that you want. So I think understanding that sets you off on a good path then to come up with a better product in the end.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. And I think dive into a little bit more on kind of each of those like manufacturing safety quality as well. I think it's important to think through early on of what are your requirements? What are those things that you really care about? And you were mentioning as well of how do you right size it depending on like where you're at in the product lifecycle or in terms of the size of the company. I think like really early on, you don't want to stifle that creativity. So that's probably not the best place to throw a whole bunch of like DFM review at things. You want to give the designers that ability to just like throw a bunch of spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks. And they might come up with some ideas which are totally out of left field, like super creative. And you might look at that and say, oh, wow, that's going to be super expensive, super complicated. But it might be the only thing that actually meets the structural requirements. Yep. So if you stifle that too early, you're not letting somebody come up with a potential solution which could work. So I think for manufacturing, I like to put it into three buckets. So first bit is just build a part that works. Yep. You want something that actually functions, that meets those design requirements. And then from there, focus on how do we improve the yield? So can you build the same thing reliably, something that actually works? And then from there, your next focus is on how do you improve the rate? So in some cases, I think for the TFMC that we built at CFS, were there elements of that which were a little bit more challenging from a manufacturing perspective? Like, absolutely. But was that what the physics of the magnet required? Yes. So we built what was needed. And then as we got into switching over to building mini magnets for Spark, that's when we started focusing on, okay, how do we actually build something that we can manufacture really quickly? And so that's when you actually get a lot more benefit from doing a lot of these DFM loops, is thinking through not just building like one prototype, needing to build like many of a thing in production. So I would say that's the important part for manufacturing. I would say for quality, really important to figure out how do you right size quality for that stage of the product? I think your quality requirements for R&D and prototype phases are very different compared to production. And if you're building something in R&D, and that's when you want things to fail, like we mentioned, right? You want to figure out what works and what doesn't work. And if you're suddenly putting a whole bunch of documentation requirements and paperwork and writing a whole bunch of non-conformance reports, and you're not actually being able to build, right? All that's doing is throwing sand in the gears and slowing you down. I think at that point, let the team have that kind of unfettered access to just try things, see what works. And then once you get actually a product that works, okay, then you start figuring out, all right, how do we build many of that thing? And then that's when you need to start putting stronger quality requirements in place. And I think lastly, for safety, I think a big one there is just use common sense, right? There's a lot of things that you can get lost in the weeds on, should we do X, Y, or Z thing? And the only question you need to answer is, will this keep people safe? That's all you have to think about. There's a helpful safety tool, a really helpful thing called the energy wheel. And so it has a bunch of different kind of sources of energy. So like gravity is one, right? So that makes more common sense if you don't want to have a really heavy thing above your head. So that one makes sense. Pressure is another one as well, right? That's the biggest source of energy. Temperature, chemicals, kind of those types of things. It's like if you're looking at the energy wheel and saying, all right, these are all of the things that are can go from some like very high potential energy to really dangerous kinetic energy, right? Those are important things to kind of keep in mind from a safety perspective. And I think one other thing I'll add on safety is you really want to create a positive safety culture where everybody feels ownership of safety. It's not just the team and not just the responsibility of the EHS team. It really has to be every single person feels responsible for their own safety, for their team's safety. And I think starting that culture really early then means that you have not just, you can never scale your safety team to match. You can't equal like 1,000 person safety team. So it's like, how do you empower every person to basically be a safety champion?
Yes. I think you hit on some very nuanced stuff, specifically when you were talking about the implementation of DFX into the design stage and like being able to not constrain the problem before like good ideas flow out. I will actually give one personal example. In one of the companies that I was with, we were designing ion thrusters and we had the opportunity to go back to square one in the design. And there was a lot of fight between the systems engineering team and the mechanical engineering team. The mechanical engineering team was like, let us cook. They were like, let us just create all of these different concepts and let's look into it. And the systems engineering team was, no, we need to write the requirements and we need to stick to the requirements and we need to find the thing. And so there was this like huge juxtaposition of, I guess, like a engineering ethos. And what we ended up doing was let's like have very high level requirements that like these are absolute no-goes, right? But then the mechanical team has the freedom to like think of anything they want. And what happened was actually, as you said, they had ideas that were just like, absolutely no, that is not what we're building. But one of them actually sparked an idea out of someone else. That like it was like the wrong idea that led to the right idea. And I feel like you close those doors if you don't have those wrong ideas kind of flourish. So that was a super nuanced thing that you just talked about that I want people to maybe rewind and re-listen to. It makes so much of a difference the way that you approach that. And I mean, in terms of quality and safety, I completely agree with you.
Add to that manufacturing piece too, I think the way that plays out at CFS is we actually have a technical review board to look at technical decisions. So something that is really impactful to the design and performance of the machine. And that is completely separate from the change control board, which is looking at impacts to schedule and cost. Because we want to be able to make a sound technical decision agnostic of schedule and cost. And then it may be something where we say, all right, it passes the technical review board. We say, great, that's a good design. It moves on to the change control board and we say, actually, that's going to delay schedule by a month, or the cost is going to be X millions of dollars or something that's like very impactful. Then it might go back to the design engineers and say, all right, come up with a solution that is faster to implement or less expensive. But we want to make sure that those are completely separate conversations where you're not having people who are in charge of the schedule and the money say, I'm going to nix that design without actually like it needs to start with, does this actually work? Does it meet the requirements? Does it help us achieve the mission that we're after?
That makes a ton of sense. It's like basically functional filtering. I love that. Yeah. I think that it also removes the contentious debate between two fully different metrics. Okay, so off to my slightly more spicy question, which I think is really, so I had an event for this podcast. And I put out these common pitfalls and had people vote on them to see how many people have seen it happen or experienced it happen. And the most votes were given to the one where it was failing to transition from R&D into a product mindset. So just to tee up the question there, How do you clearly distribute responsibilities among products that need to graduate from R&D into production? And how does that kind of transition happen? I see you smiling.
Yep. I'm not the least bit surprised. This is the most heavily voted one. And Sarah, I'm thinking back to years past when you and I and several others were locked ourselves in a conference room for a week going through all the responsibilities of R&D versus production. So yeah, you and I have this.
Yes, we have. Bring back oat.
Yep. Yeah, I think some of it plays into what we were mentioning earlier about don't stifle creativity early. And there are certain things that you'll want to set up in a production environment, stricter quality controls, very well-documented work instructions, because you want to build a reliable, repeatable process. In the R&D space, you don't know what that answer looks like yet. If you have all those things in place, if you're requiring a whole bunch of documentation, a whole bunch of kind of this extra weight, then you're going to have less chances of iteration and less chances of getting it right. So I think it's important in the R&D stage to have that flexibility to try things, to move fast and break things and see what works. I think some amount of even like light documentation is helpful because after you figure out something that works, you want to know how did you do it?
Yes.
I think in that standpoint, it can be as simple as like just taking pictures along the way, right? And having a notebook next to you and being like, oh, I did this. This doesn't need to be something really heavyweight, right? It's like you want to keep it light and be able to move fast, but you also don't want to throw all the ingredients into the pot and then say, wow, this is like the best sauce I've ever tasted, but I don't have the recipe. You want to be able to have that. Yeah. So I think in terms of like, how do you figure out those responsibilities? I think like at a really high level, the most important thing to remind the team is we're all one team, right? It's not R&D versus production. It's not design versus R&D versus production, however you want to split it. It's like, we're all here to do one thing together. Let's focus on that. So I think setting that as the table stakes is really helpful. And then if people agree to that, then you can move up from there. I would say as well, when you're in that really blurry zone of trying to take a product from R&D into production, in some cases, it's just helpful to just write down every task that needs to get done. And then from there, assign each task to an owner. So I think having that accountability is really helpful. And then it's like, all right, task like five goes to this person. Oh, they happen to be on the R&D team. And then, oh, task number nine, that's going to this person. They happen to be on the production team, right? It's not, oh, this is R&D versus production. It's this individual is doing this task to get this mission done. And I think more formally, there's methods like the RACI matrix. RACI is the responsible, accountable, consulted, and informed. I personally find those very confusing. Yeah, you mentioned the oat matrix, which I developed as a simpler method. And this gave me a really simple...
Trademark pending by Darby Dunn.
Who is the owner? Who is the approver? And who's the team member? I think it helps just make that really clear. Who's getting the job done? Who has to approve it? And then who's part of the team to make that happen? I think one other helpful tool that we've used a lot at CFS is we call it R2A2. So it's a roles, responsibilities, authorities, and accountabilities. So I think that's been helpful as well to say, okay, this job title or this role has this set of R2A2s. And so it's helpful to give somebody when they first start and to say, great, here's your role. Here's what you're responsible for. Here's your authority, aka like you can sign off on POs up to this dollar amount. You are signing off on drawings, like those types of things. And then ultimately, what are you accountable for? So at the end of the day or annual performance review time, what are you being held accountable for?
Mm-hmm. I think that makes a ton of sense. And I think like you and I did something that most people probably don't do, where it's like years after that conversation, we also did like a post-mortem because we're just like operations nerds. And we were just like, what could we have done better at that? And it's just like determining scope and like understanding like where does that handoff actually happen and having like consensus early on helps a lot, I think. And everyone knows like what their ownership, where the ownership expires in a way. And that's it. Maybe expires is a strong word, but just transitions. So in the interest of time, I'm actually going to cut to our mid-segment, which is our hardware horror stories. I'm sure you have many, and I'm so eager to learn at least one of them. So please, enlighten us.
Hi, listeners. I hope that you're enjoying the episode. I just wanted to come back on here to remind you that this episode is sponsored by Onshape, Jigga, and Allspice.
Onshape is the only cloud-native product development platform, and now you can apply to be a part of their Onshape Startup Program that essentially gives eligible hardware startups a free year of Onshape Professional. And you can apply now at onshape.pro/thebuildercircle. You can also find this link in the show notes. And now I'd like to introduce our second sponsor, Jigga. Most hardware teams choose between two bad options. Instant quote platforms that trade away supplier relationships for speed, good for one-offs, not great for building a real supply chain. Or local shops that offer trust but hit capacity walls and go silent on quotes. Jigga combines the best of both. Direct access to vetted manufacturers, reliable capacity from R&D to production. You speak directly to the machinists, explain exactly what's needed, and ensure it's done right the first time. And when you come back to the same manufacturers, they already know your specifications and technical needs. They maintain that knowledge so you consistently get reliable quality without having to start over every time. Learn more at jigga.io. And finally, on to our third sponsor, Allspice. When an electrical engineer told me a hardware story where a schematic was checked, but when it arrived, it kept short-circuiting. So after many long tests, they realized it was because a component was flipped, which made the circuit short. One critical detail in a design review could result in a complete board respin, months of delay, and a lot of stress. Allspice is solving this with Darcy, an AI design review agent purpose-built for hardware teams. Darcy analyzes your schematics against component data sheets to catch high-impact issues during a first-pass review. Darcy flags things like voltage mismatches, incorrect pin configurations, and component compatibility problems before they derail your schedule or turn into expensive rework. Visit allspice.io and check out how Darcy can help your reviews.
Yeah, I think the one that I felt most viscerally was for a system that I owned at SpaceX. This was when I was... I think it was the manager of the fluid systems for the Dragon spacecraft.
Oh, jeez.
And we had just launched Dragon into space. It's separated from the rocket, and it's going through all of the initialization sequences for the spacecraft. And I'm sitting behind mission control, cheering as the whole thing goes off. And then I noticed for the timing that the solar arrays didn't deploy. Oh. And I know that they deploy only after the propulsion system initializes. So I knew something was wrong with the propulsion system. So I like ran back to my desk, started looking at all the GUIs, all the data. I was like, oh crap. One of these, actually three of the valves weren't opening.
Oh, jeez.
These valves are how you get the pressurized gas to flow through the system, pressurize the propellant tanks. That then puts all the propellant to the engines so that they're ready to fire. And so we found out three of the four valves weren't opening. And it was pretty terrifying. So I spent, the launch was like pretty early in the morning. I think I worked until like past midnight, just combing through all these build reports, trying to figure out what happened. We're calling the vendor for these valves and just really digging deep on everything. So we were able to uncover that the vendor made a small change in the valve that they thought was minor enough that it didn't require a revision and it didn't require a change notice to the customer, aka us. So we had no idea that this part had been modified. And what they ended up modifying was this tiny slit in there. It's like about the thickness and the width of a nickel. So like very small. They took that slit out and they thought it didn't affect the form fitter function of the valve. So it turns out in the way that we operated it, when you pressurize the system, it actually slams this part of the valve against a metal seat. And with that slam and with no notch cut into it, the air had no way to slip around that part of the valve to pop it back open and let the pressure, the gas flow through. So thankfully, the surface finish was just gritty enough that over like many hours, enough air trickled around this part of the valve that the valve finally popped itself open. And we were able to continue on. Mission was completely successful. But yeah, that was a pretty terrifying 12 plus hours of my life, or like 24 hours of my life until that was resolved. God. And so, yeah, we ended up finding, we traced all the way back to this design change at the supplier that we weren't notified about. And also found a really key feature is that we actually didn't test that entire valve panel exactly like we fly. Big mantra at SpaceX that came out of this and a couple other incidents was the mantra of like test like you fly. And so it means on the ground, test everything exactly like you would see it in flight. And so what we found is that when we were testing out this whole valve panel, we were actually slowly increasing the pressure. And so we never caught this failure because it's different than the slam, the big slug of pressure that we actually see in operations. So we completely modified the entire test procedure. We were able to actually screen for that failure ahead of time. We were able to make design changes again at the supplier. And then it also led us to review like every single test procedure that we had for the entire spacecraft and said, all right, are we missing anything else? Is there anything else that we're not testing like we fly? So that was like hugely helpful for kind of like the reliability of the spacecraft from then on.
That is wild. And also just shocking from the standpoint of a valve is possibly the highest TRL component you can probably find in the world. Just like from how many industries use valves and super high pressure valves, from the oil and gas industry, let alone everything. So test as you fly, my God.
Yeah.
But I could also totally see a very reasonable decision being made to say, you know what, these are super high TRL parts and we're operating them well within their operation window and we need to go fast, so we don't need to test these. That could easily be a decision.
I mean, we were testing them, but we just weren't testing them in like exactly the same pressure ramp up. We went from zero PSI to X PSI, but the path we took there was much more, slower progression up to the pressure as opposed to just flood it all at once.
Yeah, I guess I'm saying like, even though you were testing it, I could see a really early stage startup making the decision to not, because it's just like a proven thing. There's bigger fish to fry and you just can't boil the ocean when it comes to your testing strategy. So it's just shocking that something this critical, like small, could cause such a critical failure. And all that to say, have a risk register and a failure modes analysis, I suppose.
Trust but verify, right? Vendors are doing their best. And you mentioned, like, they have generally, these valves are built by the thousands and they supply all these different customers all over the world. But you might be using that valve in, like, the one way that they didn't test for, or they didn't design for. If you're really pushing the limits on things, it's really important to test it yourself. Yeah, you want to trust your suppliers, but you also want to verify that it actually works. And I think that's also, too, there's a difference between how do you test at a component level versus how do you test at an integrated system level, right? You can't model every tiny little nuance of a system. Really, the best way you're going to learn, you're going to get that data, is by testing it in real life.
Absolutely. No, totally. That makes a ton of sense. Wow. That was honestly such a great hardware horror story. That was one of the most detailed ones that we got. That's just so clear. I really appreciate you sharing it. So diving back into our questions, I guess, we talked about this kind of move fast, fail fast, learn fast. How do you think you can do this without breaking the bank? And how can you have strategic pauses and moments to reduce risk when you're doing that?
Yeah, I think it's important to know that slogan doesn't mean run fast blindly, right? It's spend time upfront doing your research, talk to external experts, come up with your own hypotheses, and then test.
Yeah.
And I think it's also important try to figure out what is the smallest scale that you can possibly test that is still representative of the thing that you want to prove out. And then we are doing the small scale experiments. It's faster, cheaper, right? You really want to get through that iterative loop learning cycle as quickly as possible before you start moving on to bigger, more expensive hardware. I think a good example of that at CFS, I think we've done that like really well. When I started at CFS, we were making magnets that were roughly the size of a dinner plate. And we mentioned the TFMC, we're roughly 10 feet in length. Now we're building magnets that are 20 feet in length. Arc magnets will be almost double that again, so like almost 40 feet in length. So from those, we're trying things out at the smaller scale. So we're able to build faster turnarounds, less expensive if you break something. And I think not just the magnet side, right? Like what we're building right now for Spark, the prototype power plant. So it's not actually going to produce electricity for the grid, but it's going to actually demonstrate more energy out than in at a commercially relevant scale. So we said, what is the smallest possible kind of power plant prototype we could build so that it's much faster to build and much less expensive to build? So we can prove out that technology, prove out the core physics. And once you prove that, then it's like, great, build as many power plants as absolutely as fast as you can. So I think doing that iterative process is really helpful.
I guess not to get too much into the weeds, but I do think that it's important is, how do you just mentioned this, where it's like you think about a system or like a subsystem versus an integrated system. How do you decouple strategically so that you can move faster?
Oh, that's a tough question.
Sorry.
No, it's good. I think some of it goes back to it's, what are you trying to achieve, right? What are you trying to learn? And it also ties into the test like you fly mantra. If you're doing something that is not the least bit representative of kind of flight-like conditions, or I think when I've tried to coin the phrase at CFS of test like you fuse,
thinking. That's so cute. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. So just, yeah, it's important to think through if you're building something and you're testing something that is not the least bit representative of what you're actually trying to accomplish, then that is more wasted time, wasted money. So I think some of it is if you can spend a little bit of time up front doing analysis, could even be just be doing like hand calcs in some cases that are fairly quick and easy to do, just to say like, all right, am I on the right track here? And then I think it's also helpful to think about, do you need that entire system to work to prove something, or is the rest of the system very tried and true, a little bit more off the shelf hardware that you don't need to prove that out? I think one of the things I learned from somebody at Google X, they talk a lot about they're trying something, a lot of things that have never been done before. And they're like, try the hardest thing first, right? Mm. You don't want to build the wooden box that you stand on, announce to the world this great thing that you've built. You don't want to build the box first, right? Like, that's super easy. That's one of the very last steps of this entire process. And if you're building a box to stand on, but you have nothing to actually show for it, right, then what's the point? So it's try the riskiest things first and get through those failures. And hopefully you come out the other end with a working product. But at the end of the day, you might say, actually, I've tried it. I don't have a good product. Let me pivot. Mm-hmm. But if you're trying something that's been done before and proving out something that's already been proven, there's less use in that. So I think, again, similarly at CFS, we're building the machine, the fusion machine first, because that has not been done before with this type of superconducting magnet, has not been done before, more energy out than in, kind of at this scale. What has been done before is how do you take all of that heat and convert it into electricity? That whole energy conversion process has already been demonstrated time and time again for many decades. So that part, we're not building that now. We're not even focused on that right now because that's not the hard part. That part's proven.
Yeah. And I think, I guess, the underlying theme that I'm hearing from you is really understand your risks and be able to assign them to the level of it in a way that helps you prioritize and decouple systematically throughout this process. Like everything you said in my mind, like kind of boils to that, which is what CFS does. And that's what I learned to do there as well. So that makes it all lines up well.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm very curious, specifically when it comes to engineering, manufacturing culture and infrastructure, how do you maintain it through the like the 0 to 50 to 100 to 1,000? As because that is what you were the third employee, and then there were 50, and then there were 100, and so on and so forth. How do you keep that accountability, progress, compassion, and alignment alive?
I think the culture part is super important, and we've talked a lot about strategy so far, but have you ever heard the strategy, culture eats strategy for breakfast?
Yes, I have heard that.
I've heard the phrase, yeah. See, I think you can have great strategies, but if you don't have like a strong set of values, if you don't have high, well-defined behaviors and norms for the company, if you don't have people that are trained and bought into those things, then your strategy is not going to go anywhere. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think having that culture is super important. I think that actually starts on people's first day. It's important for the hiring manager to say, hey, welcome to the company. Here's how we do things here. Here's how we behave. Here's our company values. And so I think get people indoctrinated in that really early. And then from there, just say it until you're blue in the face. Say it over and over again, repeat it, talk about it in team meetings, in company town halls, in the artwork you have on your walls, right? Like all those things that really enforce to people of, hey, here's what we value as a company. Here's how we treat people. I think that's really important to just keep repeating that. Because especially as you go through really high phases of growth for the company, you're bringing in so many new people. And so I think setting those norms from the beginning, then people will say, oh, okay, great. That's how you guys do things here. I'm going to I'm going to jump on board. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really helpful. And then I think also as the company grows, hire leaders who are good culture carriers, right? You can't be everywhere at once. You can't be the one repeating their culture day in and day out. I think that's really important that you want those strong leaders who can also carry that message forward and really help build that good company there. And I think another thing I'll add as well, it's really important to squash any us versus them mentality really early on. Mm-hmm. If you let people think that's acceptable, then that leads to a lot of silos in an organization. It leads to potential infighting from different teams. So I think it's important to remind people of, hey, the number one team that we're all on that really matters is this whole company team, right? And we have this one mission, this one objective, let's get there together and just keep reinforcing that culture of like teamwork and collaboration, I think is super, super important. And then the last thing I'll say as well is that I think as a leader, you need to live that culture every single day with every single interaction. It's like you can't have a bad day, right? You need to be a good example, a good shining example for people. Everybody has off days. Everybody can have a bad day, but there are people that you don't see every day. And so if that's their one interaction with you that month, then they might think you're really pissed off at them or like that behavior is acceptable. So I think being a leader means keeping yourself to a higher standard and like living that culture every day.
Totally. And I think that one thing I'll add, a friendly addition from what I've seen, is bringing this into the hiring practice as well, like asking the right questions, asking active questions of just instead of saying, I don't know, what do you think about being a compassionate leader? Like saying, tell me about a time when you did a compassionate act or something along those lines. I know that's something really important that you told everyone in your organization when we were there. And I carry that forward with any conversation I really have, even when if I'm interviewing with a place or I'm interviewing for someone. It's so important.
It is. It is. And like I wear it with a huge badge of honor when people start on my team and they're like, wow, this is the nicest place I've ever worked. And I was like, yes, that is intentional.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, like nice doesn't mean people that are pushovers, but it means people who want to work together as a team, who want to help each other, who want to teach as much as the next person wants to learn from them. It's like having that like really generally positive work environment. It makes it a nicer place to be, right? It's like you enjoy your work a lot more if you enjoy the people that you do that job with.
Absolutely. Could not agree more. Actually, again, in the interest of time, I'm going to shoot into our lightning round, which rarely is a lightning round. It ends up being more discussion, which I love. But it's just, I think these are, again, like very tactical stuff that I want people to get out of this conversation. Start off with the easiest one. Just kidding. In your mind, for an org structure, what is better, project-based, system-based, or function-based? Ooh.
Yes. I think it varies depending on what stage the company is in. And I think you, in some cases, like you need all three, but it depends on how do you nest them into each other, right? Like you can have functional-based teams that are living within a project-based org, or you can do the opposite. So I think it's either one can work. It depends on what stage of the company you're in. I would say that I personally have a stronger preference for project-based or system-based teams. I think having that direct accountability is very helpful. It allows the team to, they're all focusing on a common objective, a common deadline. And I think if you have somebody who's responsible, kind of has ownership over a deliverable, they're also then in charge of their resources to make that happen, then they have the ability to flex their team however they need to get the job done. I think that's, you know, what I bias more towards, I think, just in terms of sense of accountability, I think is really important. But I would say one other thing that's important is no matter which way you organize the team, it's always really important to have people that are talking across teams, right? You want people to share best practices, share lessons learned. Because if you do have teams where you maybe have manufacturing engineers on one project-based team and you have manufacturing engineers on a different project-based team, right? You want those manufacturing engineers to collaborate with each other. You want those leaders to meet regularly and say, all right, how do we level manufacturing engineers for performance reviews? Do we have a standard template on writing work instructions, right? You can have kind of those backbone things all together, regardless of whether there are manufacturing engineers reporting to a functional team or if all the manufacturing engineers reporting to one manufacturing leader who then is working on a project in a dotted line fashion.
Yeah. I think that is so true, where the common pushback always comes of just, if we have like project-based teams and we have functions under them, then there will be no standard operating procedure for the company. Whereas no, it's like, you can still have that. It's just up to, it's basically like, you need to be aware that might be a risk of happening. So you just build that connective tissue and operate off of that and have that kind of, because there's also probably some lessons learned that could be transferred to, even if it's a different project, et cetera.
Yeah. And yeah, I think either way can work, and either way has their pluses and their minuses. So I think no matter what, it's like, it always comes back to just talk to people.
Right.
It's like, you need to work together on a project together. You need to work together to have some common language, kind of best practices. Either way you structure it, so just make sure you're talking to people and fair enough.
And one last thing I'll say is, with the system-based one, I think it also provides a lot more leadership opportunities for ICs, which I think is very underrated and very important, in my opinion. So I have the similar bias. And I think it's because of my time at CFS and seeing how well it worked when we were in that stage. I'll ask, like, touch structure or no structure in the early stage, which we touched on, which is like more generally broadly talking.
Yeah, I'm a bigger proponent for the light touch structure. Mm-hmm. I think people like a little bit of structure on their work, right? You don't want to stifle creativity. You don't want to micromanage people. But I think one thing I learned from Gwen Shotwell, so she's the COO and president at SpaceX. Mm-hmm. And one thing she taught me was, like, a good manager is a vector amplifier for their team. And so what she means by that one is, you want to point them in the right direction, then you want to magnify the how fast they can go in that direction as much as possible. And so I think I look at that as, you want to give people, it's kind of like bumpers on a bowling lane, right? You want to keep people like in the lane, keep them out of the gutter, but how they want to bounce around in the lane is completely up to them. And then you want to teach them some skills, give them enough kind of guidance, coaching, encouragement to be able to like reach their full potential and go as fast as they can in that direction of travel.
That makes a ton of sense. And you want it to be in a way that everyone has that kind of structure, where it's not, oh, this person's done it before, so I'm not going to touch them at all. They're not going to have structure. They can bounce around all they want. This other person, however, I'm going to put bumpers. You don't want to pick favorites either.
Yep. And yeah, I think one other like thing I like teaching my managers as well. So there's a book called Drive by Daniel Pink, and it talks in there about three things. So it's autonomy, mastery, and purpose. So it's like, how do you create a sense of intrinsic motivation so that people internal for themselves are driven towards a mission, driven on getting something done? The second you turn it around and say it's externally motivated, so I'm making you work for something for bonus, or I'm cracking the whip, or any of those things, people are less motivated to do that, or it's like less of a lasting motivation. So if you can unlock people's intrinsic motivation, autonomy, right? So again, not micromanaging, give people leeway to do their job how they want to do it. You can help, you know, again, give them the bumpers, give them some coaching, but generally give them autonomy. And the next one is that people want to seek out mastery. They want to become a master at their craft. So give people opportunities to learn, give people opportunities to progress in their career, to learn new skills, just try new things, right? It's like having that ability to get really good at something, like, really drives people's motivation. And then the last one is purpose. So I think that can come quite easily if you work for a really mission-driven company. Right? It's like, what is our purpose? What are we after? It's like giving people that common goal and having some like deeper meaning behind the work they're doing, I think, is really helpful to keep a team motivated.
I love that. And I think that that's so thoughtful that you think of it that way. It's the other one I've heard is ikigai, the Japanese method. It's finding the intersection between what you're good at, what the world needs, what you can get paid for, and what you're good at.
Oh, yes.
And it's like the combination of all of those. And I think that is the intrinsic motivation that you mentioned. It comes from that in a way. So that's awesome. That, as the listeners can see, Darby is you just contain multitudes. And I so appreciate you as a person, as a leader, as an engineer, as all of the above. You're awesome.
Thank you.
And then the other last bit is, I have two questions, actually. When is When is a good time to integrate an ERP? And what is your opinion about out-of-the-box ERP versus custom?
Such a
Simple question.
That's a simple question. We have 30 minutes. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. This is a tough one. I don't think there is ever a perfect time to implement an ERP system. I think you very much can start out a business running off of Excel or Google Docs or QuickBooks. And I think that's like perfectly acceptable when you're in the really early stages of something and the volume is low enough. And when the team size is small enough where everybody knows everybody, everybody knows where everything is, your file structure hasn't gone out of control yet, it's much easier to be able to find things. So I think that's okay early on. When I first got into manufacturing engineering at SpaceX, like I was writing work instructions in PowerPoint and we were printing them out and then signing our initials on the bottom of pages when they were done. It was not anything fancy, but was it easy to change those instructions because we were still trying to figure things out? Like, absolutely. Was it like good enough from a documentation perspective and we had a good record of things? Yep. Was it a pain in the butt when we lost the page and we had to re-verify something? Like, yes. So that's when a digital system probably would have been helpful. But I think it's like when you get to the point where your complexity grows. So whether that's like the number of products you're building, the volume of products you're building, the number of people that you have, the number of disparate systems you introduce, like that's when it starts getting really confusing. So I think that's where an ERP system is helpful because you have an entire database of all of the knowledge in the world, or at least like important records for parts and how things are built, what you've ordered. And I think all that is helpful. It's much more searchable as well. So I would say depends on the company, but I think wait until you get to, but not too late until you get to a higher complexity level to introduce that. And then the in-house versus custom or in-house versus a kind of out of the box. Also such a tough question. I would say that if you can afford to have an army of software developers and product managers to develop an in-house system, like definitely go custom. I think SpaceX's ERP system that's called Warp Drive is actually like one of their biggest competitive advantages. I think that allows SpaceX to be super nimble, like super fast moving. And it's like really well developed and it's gone through so many iterations over the years as well, right? So it's grown with the business. And because we had in-house developers, and they still do, they're able to iterate super quickly. And so we have a new requirement from a customer. Great, we can add in a custom field into this application to make sure that's tracked. Or when we had launch failure in 2015, we added in a whole new system called like bill of design. So it was a mix of like design requirements and kind of part trees and really flushing out better like bills of materials and all that stuff. So that was all, you know, was developed. In one of my roles at SpaceX, I helped create something called like the part portal. So you could look up any part number in the entire company by part number, by owner, by system, by whatever. And it would give you a full list and it would show you full color-coded status. Are the drawings released? How many parts you have in inventory? Are the work instructions approved? Are how many like POs are out, right? So it's like this really easy snapshot view of everything. And so that allowed us to run so fast. And I also think one of the keys to Warp Drive success is that we were so particular about that system being efficient that it's if you ever suggested anything that was like added one more click to a process, like you would get yelled at. And like you were very careful. It's like, all right, if I'm going to add X, I have to take away Y. Or like I need to do something that is like super streamlined, like really easy for the user. You don't need like a 50-page user manual. So I think that went into so much of what we do is like, how do you make that super, super efficient? And at CFS, we took a different approach. We went for more of an out-of-the-box ERP system, mainly because it didn't make sense at the time because we're building one magnet and then one fusion machine, and then we'll build one fusion machine, and then we'll go to many fusion machines. So like maybe in the future, we would potentially look at a more in-house solution. But for what we're doing now, out of the box generally works really well and can meet the needs. So it wasn't worth the time and the effort and the cost to do an in-house system. But yeah, I will note too, it's if you select an out-of-the-box system, spend a lot of time vetting your integrators because they're the ones who will make or break like how, you know, fast and how well the rollout execution will be. If you just pick somebody randomly, like you could end up in trouble and they could end up making something harder than it needs to be.
Totally.
So I think the integrator part is super important.
And I think it's also like important to note that just because something's out of the box doesn't mean the customization of it isn't like a project of its own. It's almost like you're building something from scratch, but it's just like you're picking the tools from the toolbox that kind of exists already.
Yeah. And I would say, too, if you can, write down your business processes first. Yeah. Write down your requirements before you select a system. That's so important. It's so easy to say, I'm picking XYZ software because that's what this other company uses. But that might not be the best case for your company. And you might be happy with 80% of what they sell you, but that 20% where you didn't give them good requirements, you might end up with something that completely does not work for your business. And now you're adding on a completely different software that you have to now integrate with your ERP system. So yeah, it gets a lot harder to do that if you don't know what you want from.
Totally. I couldn't agree more. With that, we're going to slowly wrap up. I'm so sad. I feel like I could talk to you for another 3 hours, but I feel like we would lose a lot of the listeners at that point. But I guess I always ask my guests to give words of advice, last kind of parting words, just to encourage hardware entrepreneurs and founders to continue down their journey. But anything that you would give them to have a whisper in their ear.
Yeah. One, I will recommend a book. So one of my favorite books of all time, it's called The Human Element by Lauren Nordgren. And it talks a lot about how do you do things efficiently and how do you remove friction from your life. So I was mentioning taking out clicks in warp drive, right? That's a good example of removing friction. But I think it applies in so many parts of a business and especially on the manufacturing and operations side. It's a good, just really good framework to think about is like, how do you remove friction from your life, from your team's life, from your processes? I think that is one of the, I think, most core tenets of like how I do my work is removing friction. And then I think more broadly, just in terms of advice, follow your passion, right? I think if you work on something that you are so passionate about, that makes so much of a difference, right? It's like your motivation increases tenfold. You're excited to do what you go to your work every day. And it just, yeah, it just leads to you being an exceptional person. And I think breed that environment around you. So I think really follow what you're most passionate about, find what that is. And I would say as well, I think with that passion, like it also breeds tenacity. And if there's something you really want to do, you think you have a great idea, be tenacious, keep going. And I think especially for people that are in early stage startups, you'll probably have a lot of people telling you that it's not going to work. But if they're not in the weeds with you every day, they don't see your analysis that shows this thing will work. They're not there looking at your R&D test results saying, I think I have something here. Just ignore them or use that as fuel. I think that's sometimes a motivator for me as well when somebody's, that'll never happen. I'm like, just watch
me.
Yeah. When we first started talking about landing rockets back from space at SpaceX and everybody thought we were nuts. That's never going to happen. That's never possible. Rockets have been around for so long and nobody's ever been able to make that happen. We said, yeah, but the physics say that it's possible. We ran this analysis. We think we have better guidance, navigation, and control software than what existed 40 years ago. So we're going to try. And did we blow up many rockets on landing when we were attempting it? Yeah, we did. But when that first rocket landed back from space, like that was a freaking huge day. And like we were all behind mission control, jumping up and down and screaming. And it was, hey, we made it work. And I think the same is true at CFS as well, where people have said, yeah, Fusion, maybe great for a science experiment, but never for a commercial entity. And we say, we've done the math. The physics shows that it will work. Is it going to be a challenge to build it? Yeah. We're going to butt off every day to make it happen and we'll figure it out. We'll get there. And just you wait.
Hell yeah. And I guess to summarize all of that, in addition to what you just said, don't be a jerk while doing it.
Yes.
You can be tenacious. You can be passionate, but don't be a jerk. That doesn't give you any leeway to be a jerk.
Yeah, I would say more positively, be kind.
Be kind.
Kind to one another. Be kind to yourself.
Goes along. I like that better. I like that better. I should have started with that. Oh, shucks. Anyway, thank you so much, Darby. This was so fun for me and just reliving through everything and knowing that CFS and any other project in the world that has you a part of it has, they're just the luckiest ever. And I am so excited to see all that you do and continue to be just like witnessing your miracles and your wonder. So thank you so much for your time. I hope that this was enjoyable for you too. To
share it all out. The fun.
Good. Thank you so much. And yeah, stay tuned.
Sounds good. Thanks.